So today we continue our discussion of the Z2 topological order. So I remind you that our basic ingredient is the Hamiltonian of the toric code that can be written in this way. And again, the definition of the AS operators are the following. And similarly for the Plaquette operators BP. And let me draw again our square lattice. So here we have also defined our string operators. So we have two types of string operators. We have strings that run on the links of the lattice. So let me call this string gamma. And they can be either open strings or closed strings. So the generic definition of a string operator for a curve that runs on the lattice is the product of sigma z over all the spins that are on these links, okay? And you can immediately see that the Plaquette operator is such a string operator. In particular, it corresponds to this closed string operator that wraps around the Plaquette. So similarly, and also if I have a non-contractible loop over the lattice, so let me call this C1, then I can define, I just call W1z the string operator associated to this non-contractible loop here. And I can do this a similar thing for the C2. And these two operators give us the two topological degrees of freedom. So similarly, we see that we can define strings in the dual lattice by applying the sigma x operators on the links that are crossed. So for strings in the dual lattice, let me write it here, wx gamma prime. So this is a curve gamma prime. It's just the product over all the spins that are crossed by gamma prime of sigma x. So in particular, if I take this contractible, non-contractible loop, so this is C prime 1 on the dual lattice, you see that in particular, W1x and W1z, you define W1x in the same way than W1z, but over C prime, then they anti-commute. So they realize the algebra of a spin-off, and similarly for the other pair. OK. The other thing that we have seen is that we can define the group G, that is the group generated by all the independent star operators, so that the cardinality of this group is 2 to the L squared minus 1. And that we can write the ground state manifold of our model in this way. So we can have the span of the vectors W1, okay, phi 0, W1 phi 0, W2 phi 0, W1, W2 phi 0, where phi 0 is the uniform superposition of all the elements in the group G. Applied on some reference state 0 tilde, and the choice, this choice is arbitrary as long as it has some nice properties. One example is all spins up. So I just mean that the reference state is not unique. There are many ways of choosing a good reference state. This just determines what basis you're using in here. Okay. So we saw that for every psi in L and for every G in G, then G psi is equal to psi. So our ground state is invariant under the action of this group. And we have used this fact to prove that two different ground states, so if from phi 0 I construct the reduced density matrix rho A to some subregion A of the lattice, so A is a subregion, and W1 or any other state in there, phi 0, rho prime A, then it turns out that these two things are identical. So they are locally indistinguishable. Okay. So now we want to discuss some properties of this ground state. And then we want to discuss the properties of the excited states that are very interesting. So the most notable property of this ground state is the entanglement so in a topologically ordered ground state. So we would like to understand how entangled is this state. So again, let me rewrite here our form. Okay, so to talk about entanglement, what we have to do is that we select some subregion A of our lattice. We compute the reduced density matrix, which is what we have done last time. And then we diagonalize this reduced density matrix so that we can compute the von Neumann entropy associated to rho A, that is minus trace rho A log rho A or in other words, minus the sum over all the eigenvalues of rho A of lambda I log lambda I. Okay, so you can imagine that this is an entangled state, right? Because this is the superposition of many different spin configurations. So each of these objects is a spin configuration because it is all the spins up, but then we act with some operator G that just flips some spins. So it gives us some spin configuration. And then we're making a superposition of all of this. So we would like to understand, first of all, so do we get a sense, an intuition of whether the state is very entangled or very little entangled? So very entangled means that our entanglement scales with the number of degrees of freedom in A, which is what typically happens with the thermodynamic entropy, right? The entropy, unless it's a black hole, scales with the volume of your system. So this is a very entangled state. But we have seen that if you have the ground state of a gapped system, in which the Hamiltonian is the sum of local operators, your entanglement cannot be more than the area law. So this should be the case here too. So our entanglement should grow, should be some constant alpha times the boundary of A plus some other correction. And we know that in general, these two numbers are non-universal. Again, non-universal means that if I change a little bit my ground state by adding a small perturbation, these two numbers would change. Okay? So this is what we expect. And so usually computing entanglement is a very daunting task. It's an extremely complicated thing. Pretty much you can find upper bounds because first of all, in most cases, you don't have the exact ground state, which we have. But even when you have it, then you have to diagonalize a reduced density matrix that still contains an exponential number of degrees of freedom, right? So this object has dimensions that is 2 to something that scales with the boundary of the system times square. So this is a huge object. Nevertheless, so topologically ordered states have this very neat group theoretic structure, which helps us to compute many things, including entanglement. In fact, we can find a closed form, an exact formula for the entanglement in these states. And actually, the formula is reminiscent of one of the important properties of the von Neumann entropy. So when we define the von Neumann entropy, you remember that S is invariant under local unitaries, which means that if I do a unitary transformation that has support just in A or just in B, nothing changes. So S would not see that. And so it turns out that this property in topologically entangled states is determines the exact form of entanglement. And the way to do it is to define the subgroups GA and GB. So these are subgroups of my group G that is up there. And what is J? So these are the elements in G such that G has the form GA identity on B. Okay? So you remember that the group G is the group of all the possible loops. So I will have loops of this form, loops of this form, and loops of this form. So this loop here lives in the subgroup GA. This group here lives in the subgroup GB that I'm going to define. So because this is something on B, so I'm flipping all these pins, but it's the identity on A because I'm not doing anything. And this one belongs to neither GA or GB. So GB are the elements in G that can be written like the identity on A tensor something in B. So now imagine that I would like to, and in general, G is not the product of these two groups, right? So the existence of these loops shows you this. So I cannot give you the proof because it's long, but imagine that we would like to write a sort of Schmidt decomposition from this expression. The Schmidt decomposition means that we start writing 0 like 0a tensor 0b and g like ga tensor gb. And then we try to massage the formula. So you can see that if in the massaging of this formula, I mod out these two subgroups, the relevant elements in the Schmidt decomposition should not change because these are groups of transformations that are local and therefore should not matter when you do the entanglement. Okay? So this is just to give you a hint of why this property is important. It turns out that the entanglement is given exactly by this formula, the log of the order of the whole group over the order of GA times the order of GB. So it's like saying, I count how many elements I have in my whole group. And they all count the same for entanglement. And this is somehow because this is a uniform superposition. So it's like I have log G different elements in my Schmidt decomposition. So G is the total number of configurations. But to have an entropy, we have to take the log. Well, so it would be like that. But with the caution remark that there are some redundant elements in here because when I do a local transformation A and B, the entanglement should not change. So I cannot count that. So I just mod them out and I take the order. And so it turns out that you can prove this formula. So this is a sort of paradigmatic case of entanglement because it is really just counting how many degrees of freedom you have that are genuinely across the two subsystems. Okay, so if you massage this formula, you find the following things. So you can prove, okay, so what is the log of G? G is the group generated by all the A operators. So we know that we have a number of A operators. So we know that this is 2 to the number of A operators. So when I take the log, this number is just the number of the A operators. So somehow this is the number of just the A operators. So it's not exact, this number, but it scales in that way. And GA and GB are the number of A operators that act just in A or B. So if a star operator in here belongs to, I have to put the logs here, right? This is the whole group, contains all the possible products. But when you take the log, it's just the number of the operators that are there. So this would be one of the generators of GA. This would be one of the generators of GB. But then there are star operators that live on the boundary. So they somehow act, not somehow, they act on some spins in A and some spins in B. So the group obtained by modding out GA and GB contains as generators only the star operators that live on the boundary. So this group, GAB, that is defined just like GA mod GA cross GB, is such that log of GAB contains is the number of A operators near the boundary. So that's why this number must scale like the boundary of A. And if you carry out the calculation and use the fact that on the order of these groups, you have some topological constraints. So for instance, remember the order of this group is not exactly 2 to the L squared, but 2 to the L squared minus 1. And this comes from the fact that it's a Z2 gauge theory, because when you multiply AS by itself, it squares to the identity. So that's the key property. Then here you find exactly this formula. So it's the boundary of A, so it means that alpha is equal to 1. And then you find minus 1. And this 1 is simply the log 2 of 2. And what is this? The dimension of Z2. It comes really from the fact that our gauge constraints, our local gauge group only contains 2 elements. So if I were to reproduce my whole construction, instead of using Z2, but using Zn, which can be done in a way that I will describe in a minute, then here we would have the log 2 of n. Very good question. No. The answer is no. As long as the subsystem is contractible, it doesn't know if we are on a sphere or on a torus or we have 2 handles, etc. And the reason is that is the following. Because I could pick my state that is, you know, just phi 0, or it could be any superposition of all of the states in the ground space. But the reduced density matrix is always the same. So it is not able to see what is the degeneracy. So the two things are related, but you cannot just compute the genus from here. The relation is the following. So in general, if I build a lattice gauge theory with some gauge group that has dimension D, so D dimension of local gauge group, then let me write gamma here now, this correction. Then gamma is equal minus log D, and the degeneracy delta is D to the G. So this is the relation. So there is a relationship, but you cannot compute G just from what is gamma. Because it doesn't, to compute the degeneracy of G, you need also this relation. Okay, so since I'm mentioning it, let me show you how you build the Hamiltonian whose low energy physics is the one of any discrete gauge theory. So when we had Z2, we needed two states, right? We needed the state 0 and the state 1, because we are identifying pretty much 0 with the identity in here, because we can take our spin up state and say that the identity on spin up is what I call 0, or what I call the identity cat. And 1 is obtained by taking the other element that is in Z2, that is A, the A operator. So A0 is what I call 1. Right? So A contains a sigma x. So on that spin is acting like sigma x. So this is what we did. So if I have a gauge group that is d-dimensional, so now we need a d-level system. So we need a local Hilbert space that is d-dimensional. So it contains the state 1. So let me be uniform. The state 0, the state 1, up to d minus 1. And there I can identify these states with the group elements. Right? So I can say that this is the identity. 1 is the one that is obtained when I use G1 on the identity. So I can call it just, and so on and so forth. So this is G D minus 1. Is this clear? Okay. Now we can find some operators that are in some representation of this group that act in this way. So we have the left multiplication. So let me call it LG plus. So LG plus operates on some group element in here, G tilde, in this way. So what I do is that, so I have a cat that corresponds to some group element. So I want to know how this operator operates on it. Well, what I do is that I multiply G as G tilde in the group. I go see to what group element it corresponds in the multiplication table of the group. And then I put the cat that corresponds to that group element. And L minus G G tilde is just G tilde G minus 1. Then I have another operator that I can call T plus H that works in this way. So on G, it just checks whether G is H or not. So let me call it delta GH G. So as you can see, this is like our sigma z operator. So sigma z operator is giving you the same vector if you are in the spin up, or minus that vector if it's the other one. And this is somehow, this is like 1 minus sigma z. This one is like the sigma x operator. Only the sigma x operator is only valid in a two-level system. You can just flip and flip back. This is like a ladder operator. So you are going up all the levels, and when you reach the last group elements, you go back to the identity. So the tip minus hg is, of course, just delta g minus 1 a, sorry, dg h minus 1 g minus 1. Okay, so these are the generalization of the sigma x, sigma z operators to a many-level system. The local gauge transformation, so it's based on some vertex and depends on some group element, is just the product of all the degrees of freedom that come out from S. So instead of sigma x, now I have my LG plus. So this depends on G. And then I can define some A operator that does not depend on G. It's just the sum over all the group elements of this one. So this is just the sum over G of A GS. The Plaquette operator is slightly more complicated. And you define it in this way. So you do the product of all the TH, TH1, TH2, TH3, TH4, that are acting on the spins 1, 2, 3, 4 around the plaquette. And then you sum over all the H's such that their product is the identity. So the reason why we do this is that we want the ground, the minimum energy, the minimum eigenvalue of this operator to be the state in which the plaquette does not contain a flux. So it just contains the identity. So we associate the identity to the zero flux state. I call it flux because it's the product of fields around the loop. So it's like a flux that is trading the plaquette. So the jargon is that that is a magnetic flux. So we want the identity to be the state without fluxes. OK, so this is our BP operator. And then the Hamiltonian of the C model that is called now quantum double model is just the sum over the projectors associated to these guys that can be written in this way. So it's very similar to the Tori code, apart from some constant. OK, so this 1, 2, 3, 4 depend on P, right? I'm just calling 1, 2, 3, 4 the spins that live around this plaquette P. And I am taking the product of these T operators around the plaquette with associated to group elements H1, H2, H3, H4. But I want to restrict my sum to all the possible combinations of this operator such that the product of these fields is the identity. Because I want the ground state of this operator to correspond to the configurations in which this product is the identity. that I will define zero flux, zero magnetic flux. Okay, so this construction is called quantum double model. And the reason is that, so the algebraic properties of this model are what is called the quantum double algebra, that is a quite sophisticated algebra. And this has important consequences for the excited states. But what I want to stress now is that now, whatever is our gauge group has some dimension d. And our gamma, our correction to the area law in the entropy is log d.
One minus a is comes first.
So in the Z2 case? So I understand the question.
In the toric code Hamiltonian,
yeah,
we don't have this, we don't sum over one and then minus the operator.
Oh, no, well, so try to work it out. You see that this is automatically satisfied.
But this is for having the ground state at zero energy.
Is to have the ground state corresponding to having the eigenvalue of the Plaquette operators being plus one, which means that the corresponding group element is the identity. So you have to choose some flux configuration to be the ground state, and we are imposing that is the zero flux configuration. Then we are counting the energy by counting how many fluxes we put in the system. Okay, so this is the generalization. And now let's go back to the Z2 case. So the Z2 case contains all the important ingredients, and it's easier to work out. So the spectrum. So we want to see what are the excited states. So if you remember, the good quantum numbers are the A operators, the B operators, and the W1 operators. So that we can write our eigenstates only in this way, right? So when I put all these to zero and these two to plus one, so if these are all plus one, I obtain what I call phi zero, right? Phi zero was the state in which all these eigenvalues were plus one, and we had no loops, no non-contractible loops on our ground state. Yeah.
We need only L squared eigen. Oh, well.
We have, so let's repeat the counting. So we have L squared sides, right? On the square lattice, which means that you have two L square links. So why is that? Because from every side come out four links, but every link is shared by two sides. So the ratio links sides is two.
Yes, but gauge symmetry is inclusive.
No, there is no gauge symmetry. So the
we factorize saying that. Yeah.
Okay, so if what do you mean there is a gauge symmetry? The gauge symmetry means that we have fixed all the A equal to 1. So the gauge theory is obtained in the low energy sector by imposing that all the A has psi is equal to psi, right? It just means that we impose all these numbers equal to plus 1. So if we restrict to this subspace, as you say, then we only need L squared minus one labels plus these two topological labels.
So now we don't say that it's physically equivalent.
So the ground state is physically equivalent, because in the ground state I have to choose all these numbers equal plus one.
No, just some at some point before we discussed and said that we have H total hyperspace and H physical.
Right.
And now we don't have such stuff.
So I am using, since I go to that Hamiltonian like that, in which you see there are explicitly the operators say yes, means that I'm working on H total. So our degrees of freedom are the spins. Otherwise, I couldn't even write the reduced density matrix in terms of spins, because I don't know how to trace out things if I don't know what are the degrees of freedom. So I am interested in the total Hilbert space. So when all my degrees of freedom are the spins, we know that the low energy sector, so when U is much greater than J, at high energies, all this will be always plus one. But the total Hilbert space also contains high energy states, right? When these are not plus one. So just to finish the counting, so I need two L squared labels, right? So I have L squared minus one here, L squared minus one here, and two here. That is two L squared. Okay. So the spectrum is obtained by starting flipping some of these numbers. So now let me just add, for sake of convenience, also the last one. So this is not changing the dimensionality, because this is automatically fixed by the choice of the orders. But I am adding it because I want to show you what the excited states look like. So let's start from the low energy sector. Well, this means that I must change one of these eigenvalues, right? So from plus one to minus one. So imagine that I put a minus one here. Well, now, but because the product of all of them must be plus one, I am always forced to choose another bracket to be minus one. And I also can choose it anywhere in the lattice. So the degeneracy of this object is L squared times L squared minus one over two. So this is the degeneracy of the first excited state, because this is the number of ways I can choose the first plaquette to excite. This is the number of ways in which I can choose the second plaquette to excite, and because the order doesn't count everything. So this is the degeneracy of first excited state.
Will you repeat again why do you need two to be excited?
Yeah, because the sum, sorry, the product of all this BP is fixed to be plus one. So if I put a minus one, I must put the minus one somewhere else. Otherwise, the product cannot be plus one. So the excited states are two particle states. I might call this excitation, I might see it as a, in condensed matter, it's a quasi particle because it's localized. And now we can see that we can give a string picture to these excited states. Because now imagine that I draw on the dual lattice the string that connects these two excited plaquettes. So remember that on the dual lattice, what I'm doing is doing plus x, plus x, plus x, plus x. So if I look at my string operator that is just the product of my sigma axis along this curve, you will see that W gamma on the ground state gives me exactly this state. It gives me the first excited state. So you can easily check that this state is an eigenstate of H with energy to J. So this is an exercise. You just apply the Hamiltonian.
If you choose J or 4J, because if you excite whatever. 4J.
Good. So the gap is 4J. So the gap of our system is 4J. Well, then I can write the second excited state. The second excited state consists in exciting two more plaquettes, which means that I have to choose other two plaquettes and connect them with the string. Right? So this has energy 8J. Well, what is the degeneracy of this? Well, it is now the, you know, L squared times L squared minus 1 times L squared minus 2 times L squared minus 3 over 4 factorial. So you see that the sum of all the degeneracies, all of the degeneracies follow the binomial distribution. So when you sum them all together, you obtain the exponential that is the dimension of the Hilbert space that is 2 to the 2L squared. Oh, so in this degeneracy, I actually missed something because the real degeneracy is 4 times this. Because for every, this is obtained by acting with the string operator on phi 0. But I could do it on each of the 4 topological sectors. So there is always a 4. So if you do all the counting, you find that the total dimension is 2 to the L squared. OK, so what are the properties of these excited states? So you can imagine, you can forget about one of the two particles, right? You can send it very far away and just see how this particle behaves. So the first thing that you have to notice is that the string is actually invisible. So every string operator that would connect the two particles would give us the same eigenstate. And so you can just check it directly, but you can also guess it from this way, because modifying the string operator means that I find some group element G that deforms this string. But then G on every state psi is still psi. Also on the excited, also on the excited states. And the reason is that, well, I can put the G here, and I have to be careful with the commutations. But then, in any case, when G goes in here, then it's absorbed in phi 0. So having mentioned what are the commutation relations, we would like to see what happens. So what type of particles these are? Are they bosons? Are they fermions? Are they something else? So how do we know? So if I exchange two such particles, and the computation is boring, but you just find the same state than before. So they're bosons. They're just indistinguishable particles without, you don't get the phase. Nevertheless, these particles have an interesting relationship with the other type of particles. So the other type of particles is obtained when I start flipping these quantum numbers here. So I'm constructing eigenstates that have energies of order u. So what am I doing is to flip a star operator somewhere and flip in the star operator somewhere else and connect them with a string. And this time it will be a Z string. And you can see that the Z string doesn't do anything to all the star operators that are in between, but flips the sign of the endpoints. Is this clear? It's just like, so let me draw a ladder of plaquettes. So when I was acting on the dual lattice, so I am acting with sigma x on all these links. So I have this plaquette here. I flip this pin and I flip this pin, but then the eigenvalue of the plaquette cannot change because I flipped an even number of spins. And this is true for all the plaquettes in between, but for the endpoints. So similarly, when I have a string of Z on the lattice, all the star operators in between do not change their eigenvalue, but the ones at the endpoints. OK, so now let me show you what happens if I consider a state with a two particle of one type that I will call Z2 fluxes. And these ones, by symmetry, we'll call them Z2 charges. OK, so my state, the state of my system, some excited state that is obtained by starting from my ground state. Then I have this string operator here that is wx gamma 1, and then this wz gamma 2. Z gamma 2. So I start with this state. And now imagine that I take this, this particle. And I drag it around my charge. Well, so dragging it around means that I am adding a loop. So this is my initial state. My final state is obtained by taking the WX operator around this loop C on my initial state. Now, what you have to notice is that this loop operator intersects the string in one point. And this contains, so when I explicitly write this WXC, WZ gamma 2, WX gamma 1, phi 0. So this string operator and this string operator have one spin in common. But this acts with the sigma x and this with sigma z. So they anti-commute because of the usual algebraic properties. So if I put this on this other side, then I must get a minus. Right? So I have wz gamma 2, wxc, wx gamma 1, phi 0. But now this one commutes with this one because they're both with the sigma axis. And finally, so let me write it. Gamma 2, wx, gamma 1, wxc, phi 0. But now this is a loop operator. So a loop operator is some group element g. So it's absorbed in the ground state. And what is this? Well, this is psi initial minus. So you see that when I drag one part, one Z2 flux around the Z2 charge, I get a phase, a minus phase. So we say that two bosons that have these properties have mutual semionic statistics. This is just a jargon. But the interesting thing is that when you build the bound state of two semions, you can obtain a Fermi. So let me show you. how you do it. So the bound state is obtained in this way. You just consider a state that is made in this way. So you have a charge and the flux that are nearby. Okay? And now you would like, so the bound state is this. I consider this my particle, and this my other particle. Now try to work out this exercise. Try to write what is the operator that exchanges these particles, so that pretty much takes these particles and puts it on this other side. It will not be across the string, right? In order to move a particle, I will use an open string. Okay. But you will see that when you write this operator, this twists these two lines in order to have them exactly in this position in a way that they cross. And when they cross, because one contains sigma x and the other one contains sigma z, you get a phase that is minus. So this means that these particles are fermions, because by exchange, you get a minus one. So this is an extremely notable fact, because in our theory, we didn't put fermions. This is a local bosonic model, meaning there are just local operators that commute at the distance. And in the low energy sector, we have the emergence of some states that behave like fermions. So this result is the emergence of fermions. So if you want, this is a ether theory for the fermions. We are saying that fermions are not fundamental in this theory, but they're just quasi-particles that are collective excitations of some mechanical medium that is this spin system. So it turns out that with other gauge groups, you can have emerge also other particles. In particular, with the U1, we will see, probably in the last lecture, we will have the emergence of photons. And you actually can have a theory in which both fermions and photons emerge at the same time and interact in the right way. So this is one of the approaches in which one can see that fundamental particles could be collective excitations, so could be the effective theory, the low energy theory of some fundamental high energy theory that we cannot say, because maybe this is the Planck scale or some scale that we cannot probe, but which originally does not contain fermions or photons. Moreover, because these properties, so tomorrow I will discuss the quantum phase transitions, but all these properties are properties of a phase. So they're not just properties of this model. So tomorrow I will switch on some perturbation H, and we will start seeing how all these properties are robust. So this means that the existence of fermions is not a fine-tuning property of our model, but it's universal.